This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Oscar Jimenez-Castellanos, an associate professor at the Mary Lou Felton Teachers College at Arizona State University. He, along with Kevin Wellner and Bill Mathis at the National Center, have recently written a report about educational savings accounts, a strategy that is being used in a growing number of states to make it possible to use public funds to help pay for private education. Welcome, Oscar. And to begin with, what exactly are educational savings accounts?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. Education savings accounts is a new form of school choice, or what some might call a neo-voucher program, that would allow public funds, as you stated, to be redirected for those students who are eligible and deposited into a parent's account to be used for services to educate their child in lieu of a public school education. So that's, in a nutshell, what an education savings account is.
So what has motivated your study of educational savings accounts?
Yeah, so I live and have lived in Arizona since 2008 when I became a tenure-line faculty here at Arizona State University. And living in Arizona, it very much is a sort of school choice magnets. We have several organizations that promote sort of free market based solutions for education. And Arizona was actually the first to adopt an ESA program in 2011. And secondly, my research agenda really focuses on a related issue, which is more on the school funding of public education, which obviously the school choice program is very much has an impact on potentially. And then I was recently contacted by a foundation in Texas because Texas was exploring adopting an ESA program this past year. And the foundation wanted me to sort of provide an overview on what was going on nationally with ESA programs. So I conducted that type of research, and now I'm continuing it with this policy brief through the National Education Policy Center.
Thanks. So how are educational savings accounts related to vouchers? Are they pretty much the same thing?
Very good question. As I alluded to, there's different ways that folks frame it, right? One says it's more of a choice program that is not a voucher program. And then there's others that are calling it a voucher program or a neo-voucher program. But basically, it's very similar whether you want to call it a choice program or a neo-voucher program. It's very similar to a voucher program. There's really two key distinctions that, and I'll could talk a little bit more detail later, but really two key distinctions that the courts have found between a voucher program and a traditional voucher program and an ESA program. And one is that the money, instead of going directly to a local education agency or school district, the money goes directly to the parent. So the money is not directed towards a private institution, I should say, which would be the ELA in this case, for a voucher program. It doesn't go to a private institution. It goes to the parent, who then has the flexibility, to choose from a variety of services that go beyond private schooling for their child. So in a sense, one can argue that it's a creative mechanism to circumvent the legal issues of traditional vouchers have confronted in the courts.
And what are some of those legal issues that have confronted traditional voucher programs in the courts that ESAs kind of allow their advocates to sidestep some of the constitutional concerns?
Right. So you know, ESAs have been challenged in three states, Arizona, Florida, and Nevada. And traditionally, vouchers have had a roadblock of getting over what's called the Blaine Amendment or religious clause that does not allow public funding to be used for religious sources or schooling. So how ESA programs are now structured, again, the money does not go directly to private schools. It goes to a parent, and a parent can then choose to use those funds for other services that are not religious or private school in nature. So they can do an online program. They can do tutoring. They can do other type of curricular activities that are not private schooling or religious private schooling. So that's primarily the main difference.
You said that the first of the ESAs were implemented in Arizona. What can you tell us about their history since that time?
Yeah, so they did begin in Arizona in 2011, and they have expanded since then in the last 7 years to six different states. So after Arizona, it was adopted in our legislation, ESA legislation was passed in Florida, Tennessee, Mississippi, Nevada, and most recently, North Carolina. If you just think about those six states, all of them are Republican controlled states. So they tend to be, more conservative in nature in terms of, how they view public education and school choice programs, in general. It's important to note that although there's ESA programs in six states, more than a dozen other states have proposed legislation, ESA legislation, but have not passed yet.
Who have been the most vocal supporters of educational savings accounts, and they seem to be becoming more popular? Why do you think that this is the case?
Right. So this is what I think is very interesting about ESAs. It is not something that the general public is clamoring to have on their sort of milieu of options in terms of educational options. So the question is, why are ESAs why have they been adopted and who has really been championing them? And these, the most vocal supporters and sort of designers are conservative and libertarian organizations such as the Cato Institute, the American Federation for Children, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is primarily responsible for drafting legislation that is then used by the different states, and EdChoice, formerly the Friedman Foundation, for educational choice. Sure. And why? Because these are the folks that are, really staunch advocates of free markets, and believe that, education would be best served, if it was run sort of in a free market model, and allowing ultimate choice for parents and the market to dictate what is best for educating our children in the United States.
Despite this, wouldn't educational savings accounts be especially helpful for parents of children with special needs? One of the primary audiences oftentimes targeted for this benefit. What's the problem with this innovation for people in this situation?
Very good. Good point. Yes, to some degree, I believe you're absolutely correct that it could be beneficial for families with certain with kids with certain types of special needs. In fact, 5 out of the 6 states who have passed ESA legislation have actually limited the eligibility criteria to focus on children with special needs. However, what also has tended to happen is that they expand, these states expand their criteria over time, thus impacting public schools to a greater extent. So it's almost like opening Pandora's box once you actually have ESA legislation in the books.
So how has that expansion kind of played out in some of the different states that you've looked at?
Yes. Yeah, so for example, there's different ways. So one is the scope. So as I mentioned, 5 out of the 6 states have used what I call a targeted approach, meaning that they really have the eligibility criteria limited to specific types of families and kids with special needs. And however, the most recent state that has passed ESA legislation, Nevada, used what I call a universal model. And that is allowing all states to be, all children to be eligible for ESAs, which would then have severe consequences and changes to the landscape of public schooling and funding for public schooling. And then the expansion element of it is that all of the states who have used a targeted approach have then expanded their eligibility criteria over time, some very much in a very incremental ways. For example, adding different types of special needs students who are eligible, but others have took more of a radical approach to expansion, i.e. Arizona, the state where I live, where they started off focusing on special needs, but then they expanded to children in schools that are quote unquote failing, low income students, students in reservations. And most recently, they are trying to expand to have a universal model so all kids would be eligible in Arizona. So this is the slippery slope in terms of the Pandora's box that I was referring to.
What does the empirical literature say about ESAs?
Well, I think this is an important point and one of the key findings for this study is that there actually is no empirical evidence to support that ESAs are effective, nor has there been research conducted, empirical research conducted, to evaluate ESA specifically. Only one peer-reviewed study has been published, and that was theoretical in nature. The empirical literature about ESAs come from organizations that have a specific bias or perspective. And that literature is dominated by pro-ESA advocates such as EdChoice, ALEC, and so forth, the Heritage Foundation, and so forth. However, the previous research, voucher research, tells us that that the academic performance in students in voucher programs does not increase. So there is no effectiveness benefit in terms of academic performance through voucher systems. Both in ESAs and traditional vouchers, there's a lack of accountability that's in play, which is partly responsible for the lack of research conducted because there is no mechanisms to collect data and then to evaluate effectiveness. Some research has suggested misuse of funds, because of the flexible nature of them, right? So parents can then use them in a variety of ways and sometimes misuse them in a variety of ways. There's not equal access across voucher programs or ESA programs. So sometimes there's issues in terms of who gains access, because many times if you want to use your ESA funding or your voucher funding for private schooling, they have a criteria and they do not need to accept all children. There also tends to be different pockets of students who and families who are taking advantage of these programs. And mostly more middle-class affluent families and children. So this causes segregation or enhances segregation and stratification in schools. Some pro-ESA literature shows that there is actually a great amount of parent satisfaction among ESA recipients. But again, the methodology is flawed in the way that it was conducted, and it was not a peer-reviewed study. And also the pro-ESA literature likes to highlight that there's a great benefit in increasing student and parent flexibility for educational programming. So those are, in general terms, the major issues and some of the findings in the empirical literature.
Could you say a little bit more about why it is that the educational savings accounts tend to be primarily used by people who are more affluent? You would think that these savings accounts would really be of interest to people with fewer resources to be able to kind of create more educational opportunities for their kids. Why is it that it's primarily the affluent families who are taking most advantage of this?
Well, first of all, knowledge is power. So you need to be knowledgeable about these programs and sort of how they operate, how to gain access, how to enroll, and then what are going to be your options. So people with more resources, families with more resources, can then have a variety of ways that they can then use the funds from an ESA program. And you know, even when they have a variety of options, over 80% of the families still use them for private schooling to offset the cost for private schooling. So if you're in a family that is limited in resources, even if you receive some funding, you may not be able to sort of offset the full tuition for private education. And then families, so the majority of the families that are enrolling, like I said, are more affluent and with kids with special needs. So what does this do is actually, if you think about it, these families are leaving public schools, but these are public schools that are in affluent communities, you would guess. And so what does that do? It actually straps not only It not only dilutes the overall funding for public education that would negatively impact low resource schools, but it also negatively impacts schools in middle class communities who although benefit from property taxes, but do not benefit from additional resources that Title I schools generate from the federal government.
So it seems as though ESAs really pose a pretty significant threat to just the quality of public education. You earlier mentioned legal challenges to this particular strategy. Could you speak more about what you have seen happening in places like Nevada and Florida and what's currently going on in Arizona?
Right. So there have been several legal challenges. The first one was in Arizona, which was the first state, and that was the Nehaus v. Huppenthal case. And they challenged sort of the Blaine Amendment concept that, you know, you cannot use public funds to fund religious schools or private schools. And the Arizona courts, the district court, and ultimately the Supreme Court, ruled that, that the ESA program in Arizona did not violate the Blaine Amendment. And that, that the ESA program was constitutional. Again, for those two reasons that I've previously highlighted. One is that funds do not go directly to private schools. They go directly to parents. And secondly, parents do not need to use those funds for private schooling or religious schooling. They could use it for a variety of options, educational options. And then in Florida, there was the Haas case, and that was a bit of an outlier case. Because it did not challenge the Blaine Amendment, but it did challenge the single subject matter clause, and basically saying that legislation can only be focused on one subject matter at a time. But that was quickly dismissed by the Florida court. And Nevada is probably the most interesting case, and that had a couple of lawsuits. That then merged into one, Duncan v. Nevada and Lopez v. Schwartz. And ultimately, the Nevada courts ruled that ESAs were constitutional in terms of the Blaine Amendment. So they did give sort of the green light on that term. However, where it differed from Arizona, which could possibly have consequences for future court cases, is that it questioned the legality of the source of the funding, of the public funding. So basically saying that you may not use the current funding source that's allocated for public education to fund ESAs. You need to create a new source or a new funding mechanism to fund ESAs. So that it actually has been put on hold, because the legislature has not been able to come up with a solution to the court ruling there. Now, Arizona has been back in the news in terms of ESAs, because I mentioned previously they tried to expand the ESA program to include all students to be eligible. And it actually passed legislatively. But there was a citizenry revolt called the Save Our Schools Arizona movement, and that caused, they were able to collect enough signatures to put this concept of full expansion or universal expansion of ESAs to the ballot box as a proposition. So that will be voted on in Arizona in 2018. But there's also a case, there was a lawsuit then to say that that type of petition is should not be allowed, and the legislation should be allowed to move forward. So that is sort of pending. But what I also want to highlight is that all of these court cases, again, have been looked at and ultimately ruled on in conservative courts, right? What is interesting to keep an eye on in the future is that when will a court case related to ESAs reach the United States Supreme Court? Because there has not been a United States Supreme Court ruling.
So over and beyond these legal concerns, what are your own primary objections to educational savings accounts?
Yes, I've mentioned a few through our discussion, Greg, and I'll sort of synthesize sort of what are some of the concerns. Is basically, in general terms, what is the impact that ESAs will have on public education? Because again, if you choose an ESA program as a family for your child, you are now not enrolling them in public education, yet you're taking the public education funds that your child would have generated. So the scope of them, as you mentioned, could there be some benefit for a very small and targeted group that would then only be used by that small and targeted group? Yes. However, these universal models will be very chaotic for any state in terms of their public education. And even when they are adopted, they tend to expand over time. So there's no cap on them. There's a lack of research to support these ESA programs. So I see states adopting them, but it's really a political and ideological decision, definitely not one based on scientific evidence and research. There's a lack of accountability. Uh-huh. So you have states that do not have any mechanisms or strict mechanisms to oversee the use of the funds, and also the effectiveness of the program, to see if we should continue to invest in these types of programs or expand them in other states or reduce them in others. And ultimately, kids in public schools, I fear, could be shortchanged in terms of the funding they receive, the quality of programs and services they receive, and also who they now go to school with. We already know by the literature that we're a more segregated society today in terms of public schooling than we were before Brown v. Board in 1954. I fear that this program would only exacerbate that issue.
Well, thank you, Oscar. We're at our time, but I really appreciate the way that you've alerted us to some of the problems associated with the passage of laws at the state level that allow for the creation of educational savings accounts. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. March's Education Interview of the Month will be with Warren Simmons. Dr. Simmons has worked for a number of major U.S. foundations on educational issues, most recently as the executive director of the Annenberg Institute for Education Reform at Brown University. He is currently involved with the Partnership for the Future of Learning and the Education Justice Network. Our conversation will focus on factors that support or inhibit school and community transformation. We invite you to join us for March's podcast.